I want you to go ahead and open to 2 Chronicles chapter 6, verse number, well, let's start probably verse 40. The parallel that we'll bump back over to is 1 Kings chapter 8, right around verse 54. We're looking at the day that the temple, the first temple, was dedicated to service by King Solomon, by the priests, by the Levites, by the leaders of Israel, by the presence of all the people that came to Jerusalem during this 7th month of the 12th year of King Solomon, which would be basically October of 970 BC, by my calculations. So far, we saw how the Ark of the Covenant was brought up the hill from the ancient city of Jerusalem, placed into the Holy of Holies, whereupon the cloud of God's glory, His presence, filled not just simply the Holy of Holies, but out into the holy place where the priests would normally be working, and the priests all have to get chased out of the building, if you will. They apparently go down to the same place where Solomon and all the other people are gathered on the east side of the sacrificial altar. And Solomon immediately notes that this should have been expected, that God dwells in thick cloud, in thick darkness. And then he proceeded to offer his dedicatory prayer, where he prayed, God, in all these different circumstances, when people either come to this place, or turn their eyes toward this place, or when they're out of sight, like in a faraway land, they turn their bodies, their minds toward this place, hear their prayers. Whether they're ethnic Israelis or foreigners, Gentiles that want to have a relationship with God, hear their prayers. And so that is what we're piggybacking on now in 2 Chronicles 6. 40. Solomon is still on that big bronze platform that he had constructed to the east of the altar of sacrifice. He's on his knees. His hands are upstretched. He's facing to the west, facing the new temple shrine building. And he finishes his prayer in this way. Now, O my God, let your eyes be open and your ears attentive to the prayer of this place. And now, arise, O he who is God, and go to your resting place, you and the ark of your might. I would guess that this is not spur-of-the-moment wording. I think that this is probably calculated as part of the ceremony of the ark being placed as God's throne in this palace, in the throne room that we more commonly refer to as the Holy of Holies. This is where God's throne will rest from now until it disappears shortly before the temple is destroyed in 587 BC. He continues, let your priests, O he who is God, be clothed with salvation. Now, the high priest is no doubt wearing his special uniform on this day with the breastplate that has the 12 stones that represent the 12 tribes of Israel and the epaulette stones that have the names of the Israelis, the the 12 tribes or the 12 sons embraced or engraved on them. So he's in his special gear. The common priests are all dressed up in their special gear to show that they're working for God. And so he talks about them being clothed not just simply with those special uniforms, but with God's Hoshea, his salvation, which of course is the point of this building. It's the place where the Israelites come to be saved from sin. Now we, living in the New Testament era, understand, particularly I think from the writings in the book of Hebrews, that the blood of bulls and goats could not effectively remove sins. It was not until Jesus fulfilled all those sacrifices by his own death and resurrection that the sins could be dealt with. And of course, his name in Hebrew, Yahushua, he who is salvation, indicates that he's the one that was going to do that. But for Solomon at this time, he's using this poetic language, if you will, to mark the occasion. Here are your priests. They're clothed not only in their priestly robes, but in robes of salvation. And, he goes on, let your saints rejoice in your goodness, which they've already been doing. They're going to continue doing it in psalm and in action. They're going to be talking about God's chesed, his loving kindness. Verse 42, and this finishes the prayer of Solomon on this day. O he who is God, do not turn away the face of your anointed one. Remember your steadfast love for David, your servant. So, God, maintain relationship with your king, your under king. He's referring to himself, who is on the throne because of a promise made to David, and a chain of descendants of David will sit upon the throne of Israel as under kings to God, and all of that, Solomon says, should be because you, God, are remembering that you like David, you like the people of Israel, you want what's best for them. That's your chesed. Now, flip over. Flip over to 1 Kings chapter 8 and see a little bit of the parallel over there. Now, and there, it's verse 54. Now, as Solomon finished offering all this prayer and plea to He Who Is, he arose from before the altar of He Who Is, where he had stretched, or he had knelt with hands outstretched toward heaven. He stood and blessed all the assembly of Israel with a loud voice, saying, blessed be He Who Is, who has given rest to His people Israel, according to all that He had promised. Not one word has failed of all his good promise, which he spoke by Moses, his servant. So in this ceremony, not only does King Solomon speak to God in prayer, he speaks to the Israeli people and reminds them that God keeps his promises. Verse 57, He who is our God be with us as he has been with our fathers. May he not leave us or forsake us, that he may incline our hearts to him, to walk in all his ways and to keep his commandments, his statutes, his rules, which he commanded our fathers. So again, a focus on relationship between God and his people. Let these words of mine, with which I have pleaded before he who is, be near to He who is our God day and night, and may He maintain the cause of His servant Israel, the cause of His people Israel, as each day requires, that all the peoples of the earth may know that he who is God. There is no other. Let your heart, therefore, be wholly true to he who is our God, keeping, walking in his statutes and keeping his commandments as it is this day. So a call to relationship, obedience, commitment to the covenant. Okay, now, back to the 2 Chronicles passage, chapter 7. I don't know if this happened before he addressed the people of Israel with what we just read from 1 Kings 8, or if it happened after he had finished urging the people to keep the covenant. But this we do know from 2 Chronicles chapter 7, verse 1. That great big bronze altar that is between King Solomon and the people and the temple building has sacrifices that have been piled on top of it, but it has not been fired up. It has not been lit. This is exactly what happened at the dedication of the tabernacle, and I suspect it was at the direct instruction of God that he will be the one that ignites the fire for the sacrificial altar for the very first time. Very important to show that he accepts this building and all of its equipment as the legitimate means of coming to God and seeking forgiveness, seeking relationship repair, seeking the extension of relationship between the Israeli people and God. Because in chapter number 7, it says, as soon as Solomon finished his prayer, fire came down from heaven and consumed the burnt offering and the sacrifices, and the glory of he who is filled the temple. Now, we already read about the glory filling the temple the moment that the Ark of the Covenant was placed underneath the canopy of those big, almost 18-foot tall olive wood covered in gold, kerubim. This seems to add to that, that now not only is God's glory filling the temple, showing that he was accepting that shrine building, but he sends his heavenly fire down on to the sacrificial altar for the very first time. And now the Israelis will keep that fire going perpetually. Every night they'll bank it off to the side to make sure that it doesn't burn out. They will not have any strange fire as happened in the original tabernacle when it was inaugurated. Verse 2, reminder of what happened when God's glory, the priest could not enter the house of he who is, because the glory of he who is filled he who is his house. Now, how long did that last? Probably a matter of minutes, possibly a few hours. We know that they will be sacrificing a whole bunch of sacrifices on this day and in the days that follow. And so the Israeli priests will need to go back into the temple to do their daily work later in this day and throughout the rest of their history. So it's not a permanent barring of the priests from the temple building. Verse 3, when all the people of Israel saw the fire come down and the glory of he who is on the temple, they bowed down with their faces to the ground on the pavement. They're in the courtyard, in the forecourt to the east of the temple complex. And so they get down on the paving stones, and they worshiped, and they gave thanks to He who is, and they fell back on their, I suppose, theme song for the day. For He is good, for His chesed endures forever, His steadfast love. And we'd already seen that as one of the singing points on this particular day. Now, before we move on with other events on this dedication day, the first day of the dedication procedures, because it'll take 8 days for them to fulfill the period of dedication, I want to turn to a psalm that I believe was likely constructed and performed on this particular day. It's Psalm 127. Its superscription says two things. It's a song of ascents, or song of the stairs. There's debate about which of those is in mind. Is it a song that the people sang as they came up toward Jerusalem to the temple? Or, and this is the one I kind of lean to right now in my ministry, is it a song that the Levitical singers would perform while standing on the steps leading up to the temple of God? So a song of ascents or song of the steps. But then we have this, of Solomon. So it's one of those rare psalms that we know Solomon wrote. And here's what it says. And think about the context of the time here. Unless he who is builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. Now, typically when we read this psalm, I think we think about our own houses, metaphorically speaking, our households, that if we're not letting God do that, we're wasting our time. But I honestly think the first application of it was about the temple. That unless God's the one building up the spiritual temple, the people who are working on the physical temple are wasting their efforts. And then it switches over to the town. Unless he who is watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. I think that's a reference to Jerusalem. That unless God's involved in the process, there is no real security for Jerusalem or any city that claims to be the place where God is worshiped and followed. And then a little bit more, it is in vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives to his beloved sleep. So if you are putting all this effort in to build things, but you don't have God involved in it, then you're, again, you're really just going through the motions. It's him being involved in it that provides the blessings. And then the part that I think most of the time when people are going to this psalm, they're thinking about this section. Behold, children are a heritage from he who is, the fruit of the womb a reward. So the next generation is a gift from God, which is one of the reasons I am very pro-life. I don't like the idea of abortion being used as a means of birth control, especially. These kids in the womb, they are gifts from God for the next part of world history. And that's how they should be treated. They are special. Verse 4, the author, King Solomon, uses some imagery that would be well understood from the time period. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are the children of one's youth. What's the purpose of arrows in the hand of the warrior? They're shooting out there against those that are fighting against them, trying to stop them from accomplishing their goals. And so what does a person do that has kids? They're preparing them to go out into the world and to keep things going the right way. Blessed is the man who fills his quiver with them. He shall not be put to shame when he speaks with his enemies in the gate. So there is great blessing in having kids. And I certainly would add my amen to that. Let's now go back to 2 Chronicles chapter 8, where we dropped off. 2 Chronicles chapter 8, verse, let's see, where were we? We were in That's not where I wanted to be yet. Sorry, we'll get back to there in a second. We're going to 2 Chronicles, let's see, was it in 7? I apologize. I'm still trying to get used to this new Bible software that I use. And it is sometimes fighting me on it. So 2 Chronicles 7 is where our parallel will be in just a moment. And I think for our purposes, we'll read from the 1 Kings 8:54 passage. And that is, now, as Solomon finished, excuse me, that's not where we're needing to be. 1 Kings chapter 8, verse 62. There we go. And it's 2 Chronicles 7, verse 4 as the parallel. If you haven't figured it out by now, none of this gets edited in the process of doing this. It's just like we're sitting across the table from each other or in a class together. And what you hear is what you get. So here we go. 1 Kings 8:62. Then the king and all Israel with him offered sacrifice before he who is. So once the dedication ceremony is done, it is time to party. Now, I'm using that word advisedly. It's appropriate partying. It's a great big celebratory barbecue. It says that they offered as peace offerings. Note that word peace there. Peace offerings are voluntary offerings. They are celebratory offerings. They are relational offerings where there is a small portion given to God and then a portion given to the officiating priests as their due. And then the rest of it goes back to the person who gave the offering to cook up for a party right there on the grounds. And so what did they offer? 22,000 oxen and 120 sheep. Now, is that all for this one day? Or is this the tally for the next 15 days, which is how long this party goes on? I don't know the answer to that. But this is a lot of meat, and there would have been a lot of side dishes to go along with it, a lot of bread. So the king and all the people of Israel dedicated the house of He Who Is. That same day, the king consecrated the middle of the court that was before the house of He Who Is, for there he offered the burnt offering and the grain offering, the fat pieces of the peace offerings, because the bronze altar that was before He Who Is was too small to receive the burnt offering and the grain offerings and the peace or the fat offerings or the peace offerings. So what happens is there are so many people, and there are so many of these peace offerings being given that the priests, using only that big bronze altar, they can't keep up. And so Solomon speaks to the high priest, speaks to the leading priests, says, we need to be doing more fires here. So let's temporarily declare this whole area here to be a sacrificial zone. And let's get a whole bunch of fires going so that we can move forward with the big community celebration. And that's exactly what happened. And so this was a pragmatic choice for this particular moment in time. They did not continue this practice of having multiple fires going on the grounds. So Solomon held the feast at that time, and all Israel with him, a great assembly from Lebo Hamat. Now, Lebo Hamat sometimes means the entrance of Hamat in English. It is probably the south entry point into the Beka Valley. It's not very far from the city of Dan. And it's kind of an alternate way of saying from the extreme north of the Promised Land, and then it says to the Brook of Egypt, which is not the Nile. It is a wadi, the Wadi El Arish, which empties the northern part of the Sinai Peninsula into the southeast corner of the Mediterranean. And it is the southwest border of the Promised Land. So what we're reading here is basically another way of saying from the north to the south of the Promised Land. From Dan to Beersheba is another way that we see this typically being referenced. So basically, people from all over the Promised Land. And they did this before He Who Is Our God 7 days. Now, I want you to check your notes in your Bible text at this point. Or if some of you are using King James or you're using the New American Standard, you already know that there's more words here in your text. And that's because in the Hebrew text, it says 7 days and then 7 more days, a total of 14 days. And I believe that is the accurate chronology here. I talked earlier about them wanting everything to kind of climax with the Feast of Tabernacles for this dedication. The Feast of Tabernacles runs from the 15th through the 20th, and then it has an additional 8th day for the 21st. Those will all be mentioned soon. Mark your place. We'll get back to this.